So whenever you introduce this concept of different Bibles, obviously the Bible is the same, but different views of the Bible, people are going to hear you, and I say in my lecture, alternative comebacks or naturalistic alternative views, yes, but we know miracles don't occur. Yes, but if there's ever a possibility of a natural explanation, we've got to go with that. And I'll usually say, I understand. If you think there's a naturalistic explanation, you know, go for it. And during the Q&A, we will go through a number of these theories. Now, one time I was speaking at Stanford University, one of our top three or four universities, and I said to the group what I just said. I said, naturalistic theories don't work. Well, when you tell a naturalist that there are not really any good comebacks to the resurrection, sometimes I just listen, and this generation isn't, my experience, you know, in different places, both in Europe and Britain and North America, is that this generation's rather laid back, and oftentimes don't feel like they have to argue. Sometimes they do. But at Stanford, this one fella came down to the microphone, because it was a large room and it was pretty well attended, and there were microphones for Q&A. And the fella came down and he said, "You said naturalistic theories don't work." And I said, "I don't think they do." And he said, "Can I try one?" And I said, "Be my guest." I said, "Now, folks, I don't know this fella, and I don't know what he's going to say, but this will be a good example of how we work through a naturalistic theory." And he said, "Okay." And he said, "Let's just suppose," and it's the first one on your list, he says, "Let's just suppose that the disciples stole the body." Now, I'll tell you what I'm thinking to myself. When you go to Stanford to lecture, you think, I've been at some other good schools, but I've not been at Stanford. It's like going to Harvard or Oxford, I guess, or something. Yale, Cambridge, Uppsala, or Lund. And you think, these students are going to be really good, and they're going to give me some objections maybe that I haven't heard about. Man, Stanford. Whew. And he said, "What if the disciples stole the body?" Now, inside, here's what I'm thinking. Yes, what a stupid example. Because in critical scholarship, virtually nobody has held this theory for over 250 years. There's a reason. It's not good. Now, and I tell my students, when you're giving comebacks, when you're answering, count for the people. Because otherwise, if you give five refutations, when they get home, they're going to say, "Yeah, he thought of a couple responses." And they might remember the number five. They probably won't remember five responses. But I want them to remember that there were five or eight good comebacks, that we have a lot of material to answer these criticisms. So I started answering with some of the answers you have there. And I said, first, I said, "I'm only going to use data which skeptics allow." He said, "That's fair." And I said, "One, two, three, four, five, six, seven." And then I said, "Eight." And when I said eight, this ripple went through the crowd. Now, you know how sometimes you can translate ripples? It was like the ripple was going, "Sit down, dude, you've been crushed." Because as soon as this ripple went through the crowd, the guy went like this. It was one of those curved saucer-shaped rooms, and he went, "Okay, okay." And he turned around, and he ran back up the stairs to a seat. So I like people to remember there's a lot of potential responses using only the critics' data. So this isn't all the things I could say today, but the biggest reason why nobody has held this first theory, the disciples stole the body, I'm going to call it fraud one or fraud A, because I'm going to use another fraud in a moment, fraud two or fraud B. But the problem with saying the disciples stole the body, which is what he was saying, the disciples stole the body and then lied about the appearances, because Christianity is built on the resurrection and appearances of Jesus. The problem with saying the disciples stole the body and then lied is, now, I'll stop right there. When I give this reason, a lot of people think, boy, more than ever before, that's not a reason. And here it is. Liars don't make martyrs. Or, people don't willingly die for what they know to be false. Now, when I do that, the statement is almost uniformly misrepresented. And they think I'm saying Christianity is special because people died for what they believed. And of course, their point, correctly, is that in many religions and in political theories, for example, I don't doubt that there are atheistic communists who died for their political theory, in which case their political theory, I'm guessing, is going to function as a type of religious, you know, utopian scenario, as in Karl Marx. Karl Marx, Ray did his master's thesis on this view at our university. But they may die for that. And somebody else may die for Buddhism. Of course. That's not my point. My point isn't that Christians die and everybody else doesn't. My point is that whenever somebody willingly dies for what they believe to be true, it is pretty much conceded, this is what's conceded, they died for something they took to be true. Even if it's the silliest idea in the world. Both years ago, both in Switzerland, in Canada, and in the southern U.S., we had groups of people, you may have remembered this, we have groups of people who were involved in a UFO cult, and they thought a UFO was coming to pick them up, if you remember this, and they died and willingly went and laid on a bed after they took this poison, and they died because they said the UFO was coming to pick them up. Switzerland, Montreal, U.S., smart places. You know, we should know better than that. But here's the point. They believe, whatever the reason, it could be for no reason at all. They believed it to be true, and they were willing to die for their faith. Yes, sure. But whenever you die for your faith, you didn't steal something, and you're not a liar. You truly, even if falsely, you truly believe that it's accurate, right? And so there's a number of reasons here, but the main problem with saying the disciples stole the body and lied is that you're implicating the very last people you should be implicating. You're picking on the people who have to believe it in order for the message to be true. And if they didn't believe it, it's very, very difficult to explain how Christianity got started. You may not agree with those UFO groups, but you'd have to concede that they believe their message. And the fact that the disciples believe that Jesus is raised from the dead, I can tell you, because I'm the guy that does the head count. I count the sources. I've been doing it for a long time. I have a 700-page document that lists where scholars are on certain issues. And this is probably the most unanimously held idea from the life of Jesus. The most unanimous things about Jesus would be he taught the kingdom, he died by crucifixion, and his disciples had experiences that they thought were appearances of the risen Jesus. Just nobody disputes it. In fact, on my website, there's a peer-reviewed, non-evangelical publication which published an article that I did arguing that since everybody allows that the disciples really believed that Jesus was raised from the dead, you've got to start there to explain Christianity. And nobody had any problem with that. But the point is, if they had to believe it, they willingly die for it because they believe it. How do you explain that if they lied, stole the body, and then lied? It doesn't work. So somebody might say, okay, I get you. The problem is, you're saying the problem is, we picked on the apostles. And we ought not pick on the apostles because they're the ones that have to preach the message. Correct. Okay. What if I say somebody other than the apostles stole the body? I'd say, well, that's creative. I'm thinking to myself, that's twice as stupid. I don't say that. But that's what I'm thinking to myself, and you'll see why in a moment. But I'm, you know, I want to give them their say, and I'll say, well, who do you suggest? The Jews. Okay. The Romans. All right. The gardener did it. Well, Mary Magdalene thought that up, right? The gardener. The butler did it. Good? That's good. Butler did it. Let's get real sneaky. They see they're not bothering me. So they might go, no. An unknown Christian did it. Because that way I can't get my hands on him. Right? I can't say that's a loser view because I don't know who this guy is. Okay, that's about the best they could do. An unknown Christian stole the body. I say, okay, good. Look at the first response there. What I'm doing, by the way, with this list, I give this to you for your benefit. I'm only hitting a few high points from each of the five major theories. You probably already gathered that. The main point there is that someone other than disciples, the main problem with any view like this is that it fails to explain the apostles' experience. The world is not based on some unknown Christian stealing the body. The world is based on the apostles' testimony that the tomb was empty, and here's the key, and they saw the risen Jesus. You could say they're wrong, but it's based on their testimony that they saw the risen Jesus. You can't account for Peter's belief, certainly not Paul's or James's. You can see that further down. Certainly not Paul's or James's because they weren't believers. You can't account for Peter, Paul, or James's belief by saying an unknown Christian, the butler, the gardener, Joseph of Arimathea, a Roman soldier, stole the body. You haven't given a reason for the disciples to preach. You could say, well, okay, here's what happened. An unknown disciple stole the body, so the tomb was empty. The disciples saw the tomb empty. They didn't do anything wrong, but that made them excited, and they hallucinated. Okay? Very creative. Some scholars did say that 150 to 200 years ago. Now, I'm trying to make a point. Nobody says this today. But that's okay. If you want to say somebody else stole the body and the disciples hallucinated, well then listen. We'd better start talking about hallucination. Because that might work. But that somebody else stole the body is not going to do it. Why? Here's the reason. It's very, very important. This alone kills this response. If you say somebody else stole the body and the tomb was empty, all you've explained is the empty tomb. Now, the empty tomb is important, but that's not what the resurrection message is based on. Virtually every New Testament scholar writing today, you might find one or two. But I mean, out of hundreds and hundreds, my bibliography on the resurrection today, French, German, and English sources, is 3,400 sources. More than 3,000 scholars. You might find one or two that believe anything. But the point is, if you say somebody else stole the body, what have you explained? See, if the disciples stole the body, you've explained the empty tomb and the appearances. Of course, it doesn't work because they wouldn't have given their lives for a lie. So you go to somebody else, But the problem with saying it's somebody else's, all you've got is an empty tomb. You don't have the appearances. And everyone agrees today that if you haven't explained the disciples' experiences, you've explained virtually nothing. Christianity is not based, and this is what I was going to say a minute ago, no one's going to say this, Christianity is not based on the empty tomb. It's important. It's good. It's a fact, and it's up here, and it's something we have to take account for. When I went to school in the 70s, if you said you believed in the empty tomb, you were conservative. You were evangelical. And nobody else believed in it. We were under the spell of one New Testament scholar, Rudolf Bultmann, the German New Testament scholar from Marburg. But today, a majority of New Testament scholars, how big a majority? Well, this isn't as unanimous as the 90 to 100% I've mentioned before. But about two-thirds to three-quarters, 68 to 75% in that range, today, of scholars, allow the empty tomb. And I have a list from the critical New Testament and historical literature of 23 arguments for the empty tomb. 23 arguments for the empty tomb. It's good. It's important. But it's not as important or central as are the experiences of the disciples, i.e. the appearances. So if you think you've got to say hallucination, then you better start working on hallucination, because saying an unknown disciple took the body is not going to cut it for you. It's not going to explain the theory. It explains too little. Yes, you got a shot in. Yes, it hurts. If you think you've explained the empty tomb, yes, that hurts a little bit. But it doesn't subtract the resurrection. So if your point as an atheist, and you know, in a university group, I'd make a reference to, you know, I appreciate those who are here tonight who are atheists and so on. And I'll say, but listen, let me just help you. Don't say someone else stole the body. You got to go after the appearances. I'm helping you. Go after the appearances. Because this theory just doesn't do it. It does way too little. So here's the catch-22 with stealing the body. You need the disciples to get the whole package, but they couldn't do it because they wouldn't die for a lie. The minute you go to somebody else, you only get a small fraction of the package. You're not really helping your case. So, okay, I've heard Muslims and others think that Jesus didn't die on the cross. Okay, let's talk about it. There are several species of swoon theory. Jesus didn't die on the cross. Now, this one could take us an hour, and I've only got a little less than a half hour for this one and the next two, so I'm going to have to breeze through this. But let me make some comments. Last night, how many of you were here for the Shroud slides last night? Most of you. Okay, great, because in that just material I don't have to cover today. But I said last night, with the two-fold blood flow up the arm, even if the Shroud's not Jesus's, it's accurate. And most medical doctors today believe that when you are suspended, as I told you the example of the West German at that time, Cologne, West Germany, 1950s, the experiments with male volunteers, and all they did was tie them from a 2x4, and they lost consciousness in 11 to 12 minutes max. What's going on? And I said the weight of the body pulls down on the intercostal, pectoral, and deltoid muscles, same muscles in your chest that you work out. And what happens is they constrict the lungs, and you can inhale, but you're increasingly unable to exhale, like an asthmatic. You're increasingly unable to exhale, which isn't much better than not being able to inhale at all, and it's over fairly quickly. Now, these people, their feet were just dangling, so it's going to happen a lot more quickly, 11 to 12 minutes. That's pretty quick. Jesus was beaten severely, and he was on the cross for hours. So something else has to be going on. And there's some other, there's a lot of ideas, but today still the most common thesis is that Jesus died by asphyxiation. And here's what that means. That means you didn't need a medical doctor on Golgotha. You didn't need a medical doctor at Calvary. Because if the person, in order to breathe, the person, you push up, and you can breathe. But you can't stay there very often. You're pushing on the nails, and gravity would, you know, it's just easier to rest. And the minute you slump down, you start asphyxiating again. You push up, and you can breathe. And that's why they did things, death blows, to people who are on the cross. They, you know, they didn't break your ankles just to be mean. They broke ankles because it's part of the process. If you break ankles, what happens? The person can't push up. You're dependent on pull-ups. Push-ups are difficult. Pull-ups are harder. And I don't care how good a shape you're in, if your life depends on pull-ups, especially when there's a spike going through your wrist, you're not going to be alive for very long. And so if a person's asphyxiating, you don't have to be a medical doctor. Here's the key. Are they hanging on the low position on the cross? Yes. How long have they been there? Half hour. Have they said anything? They're dead. How do you know? Well, you might leave them there for an extra hour. Make sure. But you don't breathe in this position. And so if you're there for an extended period of time, like the West German experiments, if you hang in this position, you've died. Now, there's other death blows. In the literature, Martin Hengel's little book on crucifixion, there's other ways to do a death blow. Breaking the ankles is one nasty way, but it induces asphyxiation. In another case, in an ancient source, they crushed a man's skull. Now, they got tired of waiting. He wasn't dying fast enough. They crushed his skull. In another case, they threatened a guy with a bow and arrow. In another case, very interestingly, I think you all get the significance of this. In another Roman case, they are told to stab the body before they take it down to make sure the person's dead. Stab the body to make sure it's dead. So, that's an extra argument. And it's another argument. Around, you can't stab very many parts of the human body, but around the heart, you can't stab very many parts of the human body, let me finish that, and get water. But around the heart, there's a sac. It's called the pericardium. It holds only a few cc's of watery fluid. It often expands during great duress. And in experiments, for example, Pierre Barbet, a book called The Doctor at Calvary, a French medical doctor, used corpses and put a knife in through the side of the chest. And he said when you withdrew the knife, you could see the blood from the right side of the heart surrounded by this watery fluid. Now, the pericardium is a very thin sac around the heart, very thin. It would be virtually impossible that your spear would rest in the sac and not go into the heart. It's paper thin. And so it's thought, and besides, what are they trying to do with the spear? Make sure you don't get off the cross alive. Well, they didn't even know where your organs were in those days. That's true, but these guys are soldiers, and they know where to stab a person to drop them the fastest. You know, I don't know what's going on in your chest, but I know that that's where I will kill you the fastest. So, a spear goes through the pericardium, it's believed by most medical doctors, through the pericardium into the heart, and he's already dead, according to the New Testament, according to the account. He's already dead, but the spear wound ensured his death. There's been a lot of medical articles. You can find these online, you can look them up. One of the most influential was published in our country in, I believe, 1987. It's online. It's in the Journal of the American Medical Association, commonly called JAMA, J-A-M-A, Journal of the American Medical Association, and it was Jesus' death by crucifixion. It was a team of scholars, and two of them were from Mayo Clinic, probably our best-known hospital in the U.S. And one of them was a pathologist, a person who writes, who studies bodies and does death reports. And they filled out an autopsy form for Jesus in this article. And they said that he died due to the effects of asphyxiation complicated by shock and congestive heart failure, but chiefly asphyxiation. And they said the spear wound in the chest did not kill him. You know, if you use the shroud, You could even tell why it didn't kill him. But I'm going to have to let that go. This post-mortem blood flow in the shroud and this chest wound is post-mortem and so on. But they said the spear wound did not kill him, but if he'd been alive, he would not have survived. So, asphyxiation, heart wound. How about this argument? It was just up there on the board, first lecture. How about Bart Ehrman having 11 different independent sources for Jesus' death by crucifixion? How about an historical argument? That we are source rich for the crucifixion. We have really good sources. There's other issues here. But the main argument, let me tell you the main one. Let me see which one it is on here. I'm not really following my notes. Okay, it's going to be Strauss's critique, number 3, on page 2. David Strauss is a very famous German liberal critic who wrote his Life of Jesus in 1835. He taught at Tübingen University in Germany, and he was, quote-unquote, so liberal that when he wrote his Life of Jesus, Albert Schweitzer says that a huge debate ensued that had not been known hitherto in religious circles. And Strauss's Life of Jesus was so liberal that in the age of German liberalism, he was pensioned for the rest of his life and kicked out of the university at Tübingen, the most liberal university in Germany at that time. He's pensioned and kicked out, and he died almost 40 years later, a disillusioned man who had come to reject God's existence, an afterlife, everything. He went to the far side. He's not a friend of conservative Christianity. But Strauss gave the most famous critique of the swoon theory, and to this day, how would you like to write a doctoral dissertation or a master's thesis or something that 200 years, almost 200 years later, people are still saying this is the best point ever raised on this? And Strauss is very, very famous for this. We just referred to Strauss's critique. And here's Strauss's critique of the swoon theory. He said, the problem with the swoon theory is a logical problem, not a medical problem. The problem is not... Now, in 1835, maybe they couldn't prove Jesus was dead on the cross, and maybe they didn't know about asphyxiation and heart wound, and I don't know. But Strauss says that's not the point. Strauss says the point is the logic of the argument. He says, if the swoon theory is correct, and he's picking on Schleiermacher here, if you know your German theology, Schleiermacher and another theologian named Heinrich Paulus popularized the swoon theory around 1800, well, for Schleiermacher and Paulus around 1825. And Strauss is going after it 1835 and 30 years later for his book, The Life of Jesus for the German People. He really goes after it. And here's what he says. He says, this theory is a joke. You can't say Jesus didn't die on the cross. He said, here's the reason. I don't care what happened on the cross. That's not the issue. He said, here's the issue. He wakes up in the tomb, and I mean, you know, there's other issues here. How's he going to push the stone away? Okay, don't worry about that. There's guards out there. Strauss didn't believe in the guards. He's going to walk blocks to where the disciples are, no problem. And he gets to where the disciples are, and Strauss said, here's when the problem starts. He gets to where the disciples are, and they open the door, and what's he look like? He's hunched over, he's holding his side, he's pale, hasn't washed his hair. Think about the movie The Passion or The Shroud of Turin, at least is accurate. And he's covered with blood, he's limping badly, and he says, I told you I would rise again from the dead. Now, we had a phrase in the 60s, I don't know if it made it to Europe, but we had a phrase in the 60s, it was called, death warmed over. Jesus would have looked like death warmed over. He would not look like a vibrant, living, raised figure. As Strauss says, I don't know who this guy is at the door, but he's not the crucified and risen Lord of life. You say, well, of course he isn't. You're a liberal. You don't believe in that. Strauss goes, you're missing my point. My point is, if Jesus had swooned on the cross, here's what you get in the early church. And this is a very crucial point. You get a living Jesus, but you don't get a raised Jesus. Do you get the difference? You'd have a Jesus who was alive. And you know what you'd say? Praise God, because we believe God can use doctors or not. But God can use medicine. There's medicine used in the New Testament. Praise God, he spared him. But you wouldn't say, he's been raised to a new body, and one day I'm going to have a resurrection body just like his. No, thank you. I'll keep the body I have. So Strauss said, in spite of whatever reasons you use for the cross, the main problem is you can't get from here to there. There's no bridge. You get a living Jesus, but you don't have a raised Jesus. If you don't have a raised Jesus, you don't have Christianity. You go, well, you don't believe in Christianity. No, he doesn't. But the point is, there'd be no Christian phenomena. There'd be no preaching. Because you need the cross and you need the resurrection. He'd say, soon doesn't work. There's other issues. Like I said, you might even think about, what about the shroud? You have to answer the shroud. The man is buried in the shroud. It's definitely in the state of rigor mortis and so on. Okay. The last two theories might be the most common or hardest hitting of all. Might be. And I've got 10 minutes. So, I'm done. Just read them. No. Okay. Hallucinations, if you want to do a head count, it's probably the most popular theory today, but not very many people hold it. I can give you an idea of how many hold it. But it's popular because not very many people teach naturalistic theories, but still only a few people take hallucination. And there are a lot of issues. No theory has more refutations than hallucination. And there are a number of them. You can look at them there. One of the key ones is, hallucinations are not group events. Or to say it another way, hallucinations are not contagious. It'd be like this. I came up here this morning and I say, hope you had a good sleep last night. Hey, someone tell me, was that a great dream or what? What? Yeah, did you all have that same dream I had? No, dude, you have the dream. I don't have your dream. You can't share someone's hallucination. Here's why. An hallucination is private phenomena. It's a very radical concept. Here's what a hallucination is not. It is not an illusion. This is an illusion. I look up there and I think I see an angel, but I realize later it's a painting and I couldn't tell from the distance. And I thought it moved, but it was a light coming in the window. It's a natural phenomena. That's an illusion. I see something and take it to be something else. Here's an hallucination. I stop talking and turn and ask if all of you see my deceased grandmother, who's obviously standing right here. An hallucination is a very radical concept. It is sensory perception in the absence of external data. And that's why we don't share it. That's why we don't share them. And the problem is group appearances of Jesus. Now, you can wait till tonight to hear this. But the earliest data we have for the resurrection, which critical scholars think go all the way back to the cross, these sources go all the way back to the cross, we have several reports of group appearances, and the critics allow it. They generally allow this. Well, what do we lose in the deal? Hallucinations. Because they're not group events. Got some other things here. Your fourth reason there. Is hallucination an empty tomb or full tomb view? Hallucination is a full tomb view. In other words, the body should still be in the tomb. But like I told you, in the contemporary literature, there's almost 24 arguments for the empty tomb, and most scholars today concede the empty tomb. But if the tomb is empty, Hallucination doesn't help. But you say, well, that's where somebody else could have stolen the body. Great. But now you've got two theories to prove, not one. And two less than probable theories, you don't multiply two improbabilities and get a probability. You multiply two improbabilities and get a more improbable theory. And so the problem is on you to come up with a second theory for skeptics. What about Paul and James? Two skeptics. What is their motivation for seeing the risen Jesus? Why would they hallucinate? All right. There's many other things here, but I think the biggest problem is our earliest sources. Our earliest sources talk about group experiences. Everyone concedes the experiences, and they are group experiences. So if you allow the data, it's really, really tough on hallucinations. And if you don't, what are you going to do? What do you do with the data? Now, you can ignore it. You can say the New Testament's stupid. You can say whatever you want. But, you know, just a couple moves here. When I'm talking to critics and they say, well, what do I have to say? Well, yeah, maybe you say you think the text is stupid. Okay, I think this text is stupid. Okay, look. You're just saying that because it fits your theory, right? A lot of times critics will say to me, here's what one person said. What if Jesus was like Superman? He was a traveler from another planet. He came to Earth and knew way more than we did. And they think that by saying wild things, they're going to get past our critical arguments. And I will, if someone says that to me, if this is our university setting, and someone from the unbelieving side, sorry, says Jesus visited from a strange planet, I'd say, Bob, Jennifer, okay, here's what I'm going to do. We're going to give you your day in court. My lecture, let's say I've been lecturing on the resurrection. My lecture is all about sources for the resurrection, and we've been doing sources. And you require me to give you all kinds of first century sources for what I believe. I want to know why you think you don't have to give any reasons. You can just talk, and you can just say, well, what if? Now, when someone says to me, well, what if Jesus came from another planet? You know how I often respond? I'll say, and what if he didn't? No, I'm saying, what if he did? I know, and I'm saying, what if he didn't? What are you doing? I'm responding the same way you are. You don't have any data for what you just said, and I don't have any data. But as long as you're what if-ing, why can't I what if? Okay, fine. I'll stop. Please give me four or five first century sources for your theory. I'll just be quiet and let you have the floor. Who are you citing? Who says Jesus came from another planet? Or any other theory you want, go for it. And here's what the guy says. I didn't say I had any sources. Exactly. I just said what if, and that's why I said what if not. But what if, and what if not? You see, if so, why should critics be allowed to what if without data? And do you know what they'll often say? Because anything's more likely than a supernatural event, really. According to your glasses, according to the way you interpret reality, not according to the way I interpret reality. Because I think, and I'll give all kinds of things. I've done more research next to the resurrection. I've done more research on near-death experiences than any other subject. And I think there's some very heavily evidenced near-death experiences which argue for a minimal concept of afterlife. I say minimal because it only goes for minutes or hours after death. It's short-term. But if there's an afterlife, why can't I talk about resurrection? It's the same category. Oh, because you want to say you're the only way to God. Wait a minute. See, you plainly don't like some things I'm saying, but I'm asking you to deal with data. So I think if they're going to say what if, they should come up with reasons. All right, last one. Legend or myth? Now, I'm going to cut through the chase, and here's why I've left this one for last, and I don't say as many things about it. I've got an entire lecture this evening that's going to be aimed at this one in particular. The whole lecture is going to be aimed against this, because my whole point tonight is going to try to be to get back to our earliest eyewitnesses sources. And the earlier we get back and the more solidly we get back, the worse legend looks. But let me say something for right now. Just say something brief here. I have a grad student. He's now doing a master's and doctor's degree at Edinburgh University in Scotland. And one of his hobbies is tracking radical non-Christian websites. And he tells me that we have a real catch-22 here. On radical non-Christian websites, you know what I'm referring to about radical non-Christian websites? People who they don't have degrees, or they don't have relevant degrees. None of their people have degrees in history or philosophy or New Testament or, you know, relevant subjects. They just talk off the top of their head, and they're scholars because they say so. I'm just an unevidenced group. In fact, I bumped into one of these, and I was told that this fellow, 22 years old, without a college degree — now, I'm not saying you have to have a college degree and everything, but listen to what he claimed. He claimed to be a specialist in ancient history and ancient languages. You just pick these up on your own, huh? I mean, like Babylonian and Akkadian and Greek and Hebrew and Arabic, Aramaic. I mean, and he claimed he was an expert in all these areas. I don't know. He might have learned, like I learned, you know, a Swedish word or two. I guess that makes me an expert in Swedish. And he wants to claim that. Okay, here's what my student told me. On their websites, well over 90% of their websites use a legend argument that says — you probably have heard this, I'm just guessing you hear this a lot in your society if you talk to people — Christians copied death and resurrection off early religions that had death and resurrection before Jesus did. And the wild version of this claim would be there are 10, 12, 15, 20, 25 dying and rising saviors prior to Jesus. And Christianity is just simply the successful one. The rest of them died out, and Christianity is the only one. They're the ones that, you know, they got it from the stars, if you like that version. Or they took it from Isis and Osiris, or Dumuzi and Inanna, or how many of you have heard this option? It's so common today. Over 90% of these radical websites. Okay, now let's flip to scholarship. Major scholars today. How many scholars with terminal degrees, PhDs, hold university positions, have peer-reviewed publications? How many scholars believe Christianity stole their early beliefs from earlier still religions? Specialists. You could virtually count them on one hand. Why 90% of these guys and almost none of these? Bart Ehrman, in his book, Did Jesus Exist?, goes after these views, and he says, look, if you're a skeptic, be a skeptic, but don't take this silly position. And there's a lot of critiques, but I just want to share one with you. There are no sources for pre-Christian dying and rising gods, saviors, messiahs. None. None. Now, I debated a guy one time. It's on my website. He's written a big book on this. He says, oh no, it's true. His field was movie cinematography. Okay, he's got a right to say and write whatever he wants to, but that, you know, that doesn't usually move in circles where you can check these kind of sources out. And I kept saying in the dialogue, your sources are not pre-Christian. There's no death and resurrection pre-Christian in Dionysus, for example. And he kept saying, oh, to the contrary, Dionysus is pre-Christian. I said, you're missing my point. Dionysus might be pre-Christian, but there's no pre-Christian death and resurrection in the pre-Christian portion of Dionysus stories. The earliest resurrection we have in a pagan messiah figure, earliest account, as Adonis, 2nd century A.D. And many scholars believe they copied off Christians. But we certainly didn't copy off them. The second best case, Attis, A-T-T-I-S, 3rd century A.D. And we have about 7 total manuscripts from both of them. But 2nd and 3rd century A.D. They're not pre-Christian. And I'll just say that the message I have to give tonight, I'm going to be walking off a timeline, either up here or down here, but we have to do a timeline and show you how early we can get this back to. The major problem is this. We've been working up to this the whole day. You have to account for the disciples' experiences. They didn't copy off someone else's story. They said, we saw the risen Jesus. You don't have to believe they saw the risen Jesus, but you have to account for their claim to have seen the risen Jesus. You have to account for an experience. And we'll talk about how early that is. I end this sheet with a couple ideas here at the end, while naturalistic theories as a whole don't work. But basically, you can read those, you can see them. Each naturalistic theory is refuted by the data. No one theory will do it. You need more than one theory, and no one theory will do it. So now you've got to do it a couple times over. And most of the early critics, like Strauss went after Schleiermacher and Paulus, the critics in the 19th century, when that's the heyday for these things, the critics in the 19th century went after each other. In the 20th century, very few scholars, I got a couple articles on my website where I document these, very few scholars, my website's GaryHabermas.com, very few scholars will even use these theories today. You get them in the popular literature. You get them on the popular websites. You get them with the kind of folks that I'm telling you about.